I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to look at the Saudi and Gulf states' connections with Islamic terrorism, U.S.-Saudi relations, and 9/11. We have a three-person panel to share their insights. Many of these insights you have never heard before. For example, our first guest will be Michael Springman. He's an attorney, political commentator, and a former diplomat with the State Department. He served in the diplomatic service in Germany and India and was the former head of the American Visa Bureau in Jeddah and Saudi Arabia, the capital, during the Reagan and Bush administrations. Michael was eventually fired from the department for issuing warnings about visas being awarded without proper review and vetting to persons who eventually were trained by the CIA as recruits for Osama bin Laden. He is the author of a book focusing on his own story of whistleblowing at the State Department called Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rock the World, which looks at America's destabilization of the Balkans, South Asia, and North Africa. His most recent work is Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos. He investigates the flood of immigrants and refugees swarming Europe. His website is michaelspringman.com. He'll be joined by Lori Van Aken, who is a survivor, her family is, because she lost her husband, Kenneth, on September 11, 2001, when American Airlines Flight 11 crashed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. At that time, Ken and Lori had two children, Sarah and Matthew, then aged 12 and 14, respectively. Lori is one of the so-called Jersey Girls, a group of New Jersey widows that fought the Bush-Cheney administration for a commission investigation into events of 9/11. She was a member of the Family Steering Committee for the 9/11 Commission and struggled for justice for those murdered on 9/11 by getting the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, or JASTA, passed through Congress, which removes sovereign immunity from any nation directly involved in terrorism, including 9/11. Our final panelist is Les Jamieson. Les has been researching the alternative scenarios behind 9/11 since November of 2001 and has been publicly active in the 9/11 truth effort to bring attention to the discrepancies in the official 9/11 Commission report since 2004. He attended two of the Commission's hearings and five of the NIST investigations into the causes of the building's collapse. And Les was pivotal in generating grassroots support for the release of the secret 28 pages from the Congressional Joint Inquiry on 9/11 and the passage of the JASTA Act, and has chaired panels on the 28 pages at 9/11 symposiums. Nice to have you all with us today. We're going to begin with you, Michael. Please take your time, as we only do programs involving Saudi Arabia or the topics at hand if we have something new, vital, relevant, and provable, documented, to share with the audience. First, let me share an opening understanding, and then you'll have all the time you want, uninterrupted, to lay out your scenario. Right now...
Well, I'm pleased and honored to have you on the for you to have me on your show.
Good. Right now, Michael, we have over $1 trillion a year on books and off books being spent defending America through our military-industrial complex. Many of us are concerned that there is a financial agenda, a political agenda, an ideological agenda to keep the American public fearful that without all this money, without these 400,000 private corporations and contractors in Washington feeding on this fear, that somehow we will be annihilated in our sleep. And as a result, we do not have money for rebuilding inner cities and de-ghettoizing America. We do not have money for single-payer health insurance, nor to rebuild our infrastructure, nor to deal with global warming, nor any other major issues, our schools, and all the things that are happening to Americans, even to create, let's say, good work zones, a fair exchange and living wage work zones in the United States to support American workers against cheap labor from Indonesia. So that we have no money for, not a penny, but we have unlimited amounts of money to fight the war on terror with our really close allies, Saudi Arabia, number one, and then Jordan, Bahrain, until recently Kuwait, United Arab Emirates. And we've been led to believe that all of us together are fighting on the same side. And we've done the right thing, we're told, by going in and regime changing the tyrant and dictator, the worst than Hitler, Gaddafi in Libya, and trying to change the worst than Hitler, tyrant and dictator, Assad in Syria. At no time, not a single person in the media, mainstream media, and not even with when it comes to Syria and Ukraine and also Libya, Democracy Now! Have sided with this official position. We, on the other hand, have brought in experts who've been in the countries during the war, interviewed the people, and found the truth that Saudi Arabia is a major supporter of terrorism, funding it, training it, protecting it, opening up madrasa schools that teach the most radical form of Islam, which is Wahhabism, and then influencing the other 90% of Arab nations, which are Sunni, against Iran, which is Shia, and some of the other countries that support the Shia principles. Irrespective of the evidence is immaterial to the American public and the American media. That's where you come in, because you've been there, you're a firsthand witness, you've seen the corruption, you've seen the lies, you've seen the duplicity. Now you have an argument to make to the American public, because this is a worldwide audience, to tell them what you saw, what you know, and what they have not been told. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Okay. Well, I think you pretty much basically stated the situation prior to 1991 and the collapse of the old Soviet Union. The United States had an enemy. It was an enemy that had fought in Korea. It fought in Central America. It fought in the Far East. You name it, the evil empire was there. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, you had to justify these billions upon billions upon billions of dollars in military spending, in hardware, in supporting pay for soldiers, sailors, and Marines. You had to support bases all around the world. You had to do just about anything you wanted to support the intelligence services, for example, which consumed a great deal of funds. But with the Soviet Union gone, where is the enemy? Well, we needed a new one. We needed terrorism. We needed Al-Qaeda. We needed the name changed to ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, and or ISIS, IS or Daesh or whatever you want to call them this time. It's basically the same crowd that we created, that Jimmy Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski created to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan back in the late 70s and the 80s. The idea was to come up with the most horrible people that they could recruit to get rid of the Soviets in Afghanistan. The Americans had lost their listening stations in Iran because the people finally rose up and threw off the repressive Shah that the Central Intelligence Agency had installed in power back in 1953. In the second coup, well, no, it was the first coup. The second coup was Guatemala. So you created these people. You recruited them. You brought them to the United States for training. You sent them Stinger missiles. You sent CIA case officers into Afghanistan to train them in how to use the weapons, train them in how to escape from the Soviets and so forth. So essentially, you had a new group, a cadre, if you will, of the what I call the Arab Afghan Legion, that they just simply undergo name changes from Al-Qaeda and ISIL or the Mujahideen or whoever you want to call them. But it's basically the same people that they found, as Cheryl Bernard said, we couldn't defeat the Soviets unless we had the most horrible people we could find and trained them into killing people. And they did. And then after a while, they got the idea that, well, gee, we've got a cadre of people good at shooting things down and blowing things up. And then they looked around and said, well, look, we've got countries in the world we don't like, countries in the world we can easily destabilize because they're riven by ethnic tensions, by religious rivalries, by political factions, you name it. And they took these people and sent them first to Yugoslavia. It was kind of a weak state. You had the Catholics against the Orthodox. You had the Slavs against the non-Slavs. You had the Muslims against the Christians and everybody else. And it was easy to slip Osama bin Laden and a couple of thousand Saudis into there with a lot of money. And they worked closely hand-in-hand with NATO and the American Intelligence Services to create problems, to have mosque bombings, to have shootings and killings, which they managed to blame on the other side, whatever that might be. And it was successful. They persuaded the American people to accept this. They said we had a responsibility to protect these people. And, of course, they were very good at their propaganda. They even convinced me for a while until I began to see through it. It took me a while, but I did see through it. And then they moved from the Balkans to Iraq. Saddam Hussein was not a philosopher king. He was not a nice guy, but he kept control of the Sunni, the Shi'i, and the Kurds. And basically, Iraq had the highest educational standards in the region. They, the language of instruction in medicine, for example, was English. It was a secular state, as was Libya, the next target on the list, and also Syria. And the Americans and the Saudi friends moved people back and forth. They moved weapons. They bought weapons from Croatia, left over from the Yugoslav War, and sold them to the extremist groups in Libya and in Syria. And you had deep participation by the American government. The American ambassador, Robert S. Ford, in Syria, for example, was in charge of recruiting death squads. He worked with Henry Entry, who had been with me in Saudi Arabia in Jeddah. He was allegedly the political officer there. And this went from bad to worse. And we're currently in the process of destroying Syria. Well, the country's gone now, but it's it still has a functioning government, and the Americans have not replaced Bashar al-Assad quite yet. But all of the countries we've been involved with have been totally destroyed. They'll never make it back in our lifetimes. So that was it. And I was in at the beginning of it in the late 1980s in Jeddah, the principal city in the Hejaz in western Saudi Arabia. I got warned by the American ambassador, Walter Cutler, before I left the United States, that my predecessor, Greta Holtz, was creating terrible problems for them. And it was just awful. She wasn't giving visas to the servants of rich Saudi women who couldn't go to the United States without hairdressers, seamstresses, and other factotums. And I said, I don't understand what this guy is telling me. He's giving me a message, but I don't know what the message is. And when the meeting was over, after about 45 minutes, and I had expected a five-minute hello and goodbye session, I asked the desk officer, the fellow who follows Saudi Arabia for the United States in Washington at the State Department. I said, what was that all about? And he said, well, you know, Cutler, he's just a queer duck. Well, I arrived in Jeddah with open arms. People welcomed me. They said, oh, you're such an improvement over Greta Holtz. She's such a terrible person. And then I began getting these strange requests for visas for people who weren't really qualified to get them. It was always, well, you know, it's you're in charge, you're running the visa section there, but we really would like to have this guy come to the States and get a visa because we want to talk to him. And this went from bad to worse because I kept refusing these people because the law, the Immigration and Nationality Act, and the State Department's own regulations in the Foreign Affairs Manual say that you can't issue a visa unless you are almost certain that the guy will go to the United States for a particular person and come back to his own country or place of application because he has ties that require him to return. He has a job, he has a business, he has a family, and whatever. It varied depending on who you're dealing with. But I kept getting these strange characters, and I kept refusing them. There were two people, Pakistanis, I think, at one point came and wanted to go to a trade show in the United States. And then I said, well, what's the trade show? And they couldn't name the show, couldn't name the city it was going to be held in. And I refused them. And then I got a call a few minutes later from Paul Tveit, T-V-E-I-T, the CAA clandestine service officer in the commercial section, saying he just had to have these people there. And I said no. And then he went to the chief of the section, Justice given name Stevens, and got the visas for these guys. And I got threats finally saying, you issue the visas or you will be unemployed. And as I found out once I was there, that there were only three people out of some 20 in the consulate who actually worked for the Department of State. The rest worked for the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency. So this was absolutely amazing. And once I was out of the State Department back in Washington, I ran into Joe Trento, the journalist, and he told me, look, Mike, the situation is simple. They were recruiting the Mujahideen for Afghanistan, and they wanted a patsy in there who wouldn't ask too many questions and would follow orders. And if he didn't follow orders, they could get rid of him, and easily saying, well, he didn't get with the program, he didn't understand how to work in the State Department, and so on and so forth. So as time went by, I began thinking about this, and I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, and then when that was denied, I filed the lawsuit, which was sealed as a threat to national security. And then as time went by, I kept writing and speaking about this and filed a Freedom of Information Act request for what I should have done in the first place. The names of the people that J. Philip Frears, the consul general, had demanded I issue visas to. And I had made a file of this. I kept a copy of these questionable visa applications and had written on them, reversed per order of J.P. Frears, American consul general. Well, I asked for those, and the State Department said, well, we can't find them. We shred them every year. And I said, no, you don't shred them every year, because when I was in Jeddah, I saw bulging filed cabinets filled with, you know, 5, 10, 15-year-old applications taking up an awful lot of space. And when I asked my staff to get rid of these people and clean out some of the paperwork, they said, well, we can do that, or we can deal with the 200 people a day we're dealing with applying for visas. Which do you want us to do? So there's no choice. Let's do our jobs and forget about the paperwork in the file room. So when the second lawsuit was thrown out, I decided I would write the book Visas for Al-Qaeda and put everything into it that I knew about what was going on in Jeddah. And in the process of writing the book, I found out that in addition to recruiting these people in Jeddah for the Afghan war, there were 52 recruiting offices in the United States, and including one in Washington, D.C., but I couldn't find out anything more about them. I couldn't get their addresses. I couldn't locate anybody connected with them, and I was just absolutely amazed. But this has been going on, and it's going to continue to go on. The Americans have gotten into Saudi Arabia with Donald Trump visiting in May, and he went and made a big production out of dealing with all of the terrorists that we have to deal with in the world, and he named Iran. And he gingered the Saudis up with their Wahhabi brand of Islam, which most Muslims don't think is really Islam. It's so puritanical, so reactionary, so conservative, that they simply want nothing to do with it. But the Saudis want to export this. They want to send it around the world in madrasas and in mosques around the world with the appropriate people in charge and in teaching the Wahhabi line. And the Saudi government is intimately tied up with Wahhabism from the 18th century, when there was a link-up between the founder of the current royal dynasty, the As-Saud family. He linked up with theologian Muhammad bin Abdullah Wahhab, and the guy provided the crucial religious underpinning for the king of Saudi, well, the wannabe king of Saudi Arabia's project to unify and centralize the various tribes in the Arabian Peninsula. So they've had this uneasy relationship for two centuries, and each depends on the other to keep the lid on. But what happens, in fact, though, is that the Saudis use the Wahhabi outlook and their vast funds to promote the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, to pay for terrorists in Yugoslavia and Iraq. They were sending weapons and soldiers across the border between the two countries. They put money into the extremist groups fighting to overthrow Muammar al-Gaddafi in Libya. He was the director of the country, and the people in the country had one of the highest human indexes for living in all of Africa through
the highest. They were number one.
Pardon?
They had the highest.
Okay.
Extensive reports on
it. Yeah.
Very, very.
Thank you.
Highest level of education for women, more educated mm-hmm. women in Saudi and Libya than in Israel. Longest lifespan, more women involved in government than any other government in the world. Free education, free medical attention, no crime, no debt, but they made the mistake of wanting their currency pegged on the gold denier for oil, and that was the final straw. Plus, they had one of the best light crude oils supplies in the world,
mm-hmm.
and now look at it. And no one goes back to Democracy Now, to CNN, to Bill O'Reilly, and all the other talking heads, Colonel Pizer, and says, you know something? You all advocated this. Why don't you go there now and say, wow, my voice to my audience helped participate this genocide. In any case, it's we're aware of that. Now, I'm going to ask you some short answer questions, if you would, please, so I can get to my other guest also, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Short answers, please. I appreciate what you've told us thus far, Michael.
Thank you.
Could you imagine going into a city, let's say it's New York City, and the mayor has total control? The mayor is not elected, but has rule over, you know, 10 million people living directly in the city and the boroughs, and nearly 20 million people within 100 miles. You can't throw them out of office, and you can't put them in office. You cannot sue them, and you cannot criticize the mayor. And daily, the mayor decides that he doesn't like you for some reason. Maybe you demonstrate it. So he's going to cut your head off. Not quietly, not in secret, publicly. And they do every day. In fact, they've cut more heads off this in the last 12 months than ISIS, hard to imagine. But also, you're gay. So they take you up to the highest building, to the roof. They tie your hands behind your back, and they throw you off the roof. If you should, for by some miracle, survive that fall, they then beat you to death. They'll crucify you. They kill you twice. They behead you, then they crucify you. And this is just common, normal behavior for them. They have 5,000 members to their extended family, all corrupt. They are total hypocrites because I actually shared a floor with them in London when I took my daughter on a vacation one time, and I saw what they do. All right, I was there for 10 days, so around the world, you'll see they're utter hypocrites. And yet, no one in the media criticized them, not for the beheadings. In fact, there was a march recently, and I'm a supporter of gay rights, but I was deeply concerned when they were advocating for gays in other countries, and I thought, how ironic. If you advocated for gay and you were gay in Saudi Arabia, you'd be killed. And so there are no rights for gays. There's no other religion allowed. There's only one official religion. Mm-hmm. Everything else is banned. No public meetings. No free expression on the internet. There's no political parties. So women have no rights except the few that men give them. If you're raped, then you who've been raped are the one who are beaten. So now this is the country that all the media loves, that all of our pundits and all of our ideologues support, that each president of the United States wants to do business with, that the munitions makers love, because every bomb they're blowing up in Yemen right now is profit to them. There's a genocide in Yemen right now by Saudi Arabia and the United States. We are co-partners, and this is a crime against humanity because 7 to 8 million Yemenis are now starving to death. Mm-hmm. And all this because of the quality of the presidents. Now, what do you think would happen if that same identical, not exaggerating it, same identical behavior and that radical religion that they practice, what do you think would happen if that person was in New York City?
Well, there would be a great uproar. There would be assassinations and revolts and so on and so forth. I mean,
This city would come to a screeching. One of the things I like about New York is New Yorkers don't take anything from anybody. And yet no one in the world, not the British, the little chirping chimps, I really, really don't like that country because what their whole history of genocide and colonialism, mm-hmm. and all of them, all the prime ministers, including Disraeli, the French, and the same people that have supported colonialism in Algeria and other countries, they all line up to do business. They all line up with their press making praises to this family. And that, to me, is hypocrisy. When I hear that the majority of the hijackers, 9/11, came from Saudi Arabia, I have to ask, how'd they get their visas? Was the CIA involved in getting them facilitated in this country? Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, I certainly think so. I talked to Shana Steinger, the woman who actually issued visas to 11 of the 15 Saudis in Jeddah. And she said, well, I didn't do anything wrong. And I said, well, yeah, but there was this issue of these people getting the visas. You know, how did it happen? And I really couldn't get a straight answer out of her. But in my case, when I objected, I was fired, and she issued the visas, and she just recently retired from the State Department, if in fact mm-hmm. she worked for State.
What did you notice personally, not hearsay, not secondhand, mm-hmm. thirdhand? I'm talking about you personally observe about any of the royals in Saudi Arabia and their behavior that we should be concerned about.
Well, I never had any dealings directly with the Saudi princes. I mean, I had one staff member tell me that there are 4,000 chicken princes and a handful of real princes who actually do the work. But they live high on the hog. They jet about the world in their private aircraft and spend an awful lot of money. And at the same time, the people in Saudi Arabia, they're not all rich. I drove through the country a couple of times, and I went through an awful lot of awfully poor-looking villages with kind of ramshackle houses. And granted, the Saudis are essentially a minority in their own country because they hire Indonesians and Filipinos and other nationalities to do most of the work in the country.
Michael, you told us, if I heard you correctly, that mm-hmm. the United States was solely responsible for the creation of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan with Jimmy Carter and Brzezinski, who recently died, in its war against the Soviet Union, which you witnessed. And later this became a terrorist faction with global mm-hmm. ambitions. And from that, we saw Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, also Saudi, from a very mm-hmm. wealthy, one of the wealthiest construction families in Saudi Arabia. So you saw that journey, that the United States directly helped create the progenitor, the beginning of the terrorist movement throughout the world. And nowhere do you see the media saying, hold on a second, we've involved ourselves in over 61 elections of democratic elected governments. We infiltrated. We had assassination groups. We made sure our people that supported our commerce and our politics were in power, no matter what, who was better for the country. And yet you never hear anyone criticizing the United States for what we're now accusing Russia of doing. And you never hear mm-hmm. them saying, we created Al-Qaeda, we created the Mujahideen, we created the basis of Osama bin Laden and the funding. And so we're not willing to take any responsibility. You also mentioned Yugoslavia and, of course, Bosnia. Mm-hmm. These were supposedly NATO-backed, but NATO doesn't do anything. NATO is one hair on the tail of a dog. The United States is that dog. And mm-hmm. anyone who thinks otherwise is extremely naive. Oh, so yeah. Is that what you said? Did I hear you correctly?
That's correct, yeah. I mean, when Carter and Brzezinski decided that they would get the Soviets into Afghanistan, that they would get them out of Afghanistan, they worked with the Saudis. The Saudis did a lot of the financing. They worked with the Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI, do a lot of training there and to get these guys from wherever they were recruited into Afghanistan. And the Saudis provided a lot of the money. I had Bob Baer tell me that they worked very hard at keeping the United States in the background and let it be known that the Saudis were in the front and they were doing the recruiting, they were doing the paying, and the U.S., while in the background, was pulling the strings on the puppets. It was the puppet master. But they said, well, if the Americans were behind this and people knew this and they didn't really like the United States, the whole thing would crater. And he talked about one guy named Badib, who was a Saudi, who would travel from Saudi Arabia to Pakistan to pay for Chinese-made weapons or missiles or whatever. And he would just simply go with a couple of suitcases filled with cash. So the Americans were in the background controlling it, helping recruit, directing. But the Saudis and the Pakistanis were out in front. They were the in front of the curtain, and the Wizard of Oz was behind it.
Okay. You're listening to Michael Springman. He is a whistleblower. He is a former diplomat for many years in the State Department in Saudi Arabia. He witnessed a lot of this. And when he wanted to tell the truth, he was fired. Now let's go over and say hello to our next guest, Lori. Nice to have you with us, Lori.
Hi, nice to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Lori, when you and your colleagues and your families, all affected by 9/11, what are your feelings and response now that you see that there was a great deal hidden from the official version, that they try to downplay any criticism by anyone, they've tried to undermine or ignore the role Saudi Arabia and even the United Arab Emirates' role in 9/11. And I want you to speak about the complicity of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in anything that you have evidence of that aligns them with any of the funding, the protection, or any of the plans involving 9/11.
All right, well, let's just go back for a minute, and on the morning of September 11th, I woke up as a wife and a mother, and I went to bed as a widow and still a mother of a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old, but now we all had to peel ourselves up off the floor because we had entered this crazy, you know, foreign policy debacle that came, you know, falling into our living room. And, you know, life has really never been normal, quote unquote, again, you know, since that time, because, you know, I'm looking at things that I really never looked at before. I was an art major in college, and, you know, I had some knowledge of, you know, various and sundry things, but certainly not what I've uncovered and unpeeled and looked behind, you know, since 9/11. So, you know, essentially what we know about the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the funding of September 11th comes basically from the 28 pages that were declassified not too long ago after, 14 years of not being classified. And in those pages, you know, well, we knew that 15 of the 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia and two of the hijackers came from the United Arab Emirates. And we knew that one other came from Lebanon and one other came from Egypt. So that was one of the first things that we learned. And, you know, when we found out that 15 of the 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, you know, the first question is, well, how did they do it? You know, like, how did this all happen? How did they get their visas? You know, and we actually happened into some of Michael Springman's work pretty early on because of his whistleblowing. But, you know, we learned that there was a guy named Bayoumi. We learned there was a guy named Basnan. And we tried to follow the money since that's how you can, you know, usually figure out how a crime unfolds is by looking at the money trails. And the 28 pages details the financial information with regards to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and 9/11. Of course, it was held secret for a very long time, so we didn't really get to see what it said, because essentially the commission was supposed to use the joint inquiry, which is where the 28 pages came from, as their jumping off point, and they sort of didn't really want to look at Saudi Arabia's complicity for, you know, whether they were told not to, or, you know, we don't really know why not, but they didn't really look. And people were fired that tried to go back and look at the 28 pages. People that had actually written the 28 pages for the joint inquiry were working on the commission, and they were fired when they tried to look at the pages. But in any case, from the 28 pages, we learned that Omar al-Bayoumi was alleged to have been a Saudi intelligence officer. And FBI files suggested that Bayoumi, this is directly from the 28 pages, that Bayoumi provided substantial assistance to hijackers Midhar and Hosni. Now, those were two of the guys that were on the Pentagon plane. After they arrived in San Diego in February 2000, Bayoumi met the hijackers, likely not accidentally, during this time frame. Bayoumi had extensive contact with the Saudi government, establishments in the U.S., and received financial support from a Saudi company affiliated with the Saudi Ministry of Defense. According to FBI files, and the name is redacted, at the company said that Bayoumi received a monthly salary even though he had been there on only one occasion. The support increased substantially in April 2000, 2 months after the hijackers arrived in San Diego, decreased slightly in December 2000, and stayed at that same level until August 2001. That company reportedly has ties to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. In addition, the FBI determined that Bayoumi was in contact with several individuals under FBI investigation and with the Holy Land Foundation, which had been under investigation as a fundraising front for Hamas. So, you know, one of the things that's my takeaway is that the Saudi charities are very closely under the thumb of the Saudi government, and they determine who gets the money. So, you know, all it sounds benign. We say, you know, a charity, it sounds so nice. But in that case, it's not really what we consider, you know, the same charitable giving, you know, as a good thing. They fund, you know, some of these terrorist groups through their charities. And, you know, allegedly, let's use the word. And then the next thing is Osama Basnan. He's the next guy that appears in the 28 pages. And he may have been in contact with Midhar and Hosni during their time in San Diego. Basnan was a close associate of Bayoumi, and he lived across the street from the hijackers, according to another FBI document. Basnan told another person that he met Hosni through Bayoumi, and later that he met two of the hijackers through Bayoumi. He also told the FBI asset that Bayoumi was arrested because he knew Hosni and Midhar very well. The document says that Basnan and Bayoumi have been close to each other for a long time. Basnan had many ties to the Saudi government, including past employment by the Saudi Arabian Education Mission, referred to in FBI documents as, and it's redacted, but we think it may be the Saudi Arabian Cultural Mission, or the SACM. The FBI also received reports from individuals in the Muslim community alleging that Basnan might be a Saudi intelligence officer. According to a CIA memo, Basnan reportedly received funding and possibly a fake passport from the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. and his wife. A CIA report also indicates that Basnan traveled to Houston in 2002 and met with an individual who was redacted, and that could be, you know, Prince Bandar, but of course that's alleged. The report states that during a trip, and that's alleged by me because it was redacted. The report states that during a trip, a member of the Saudi royal family provided Basnan with a significant amount of cash. The FBI info indicated that Basnan is an extremist and a supporter of UBL and has been connected to the Eritrean Islamic Jihad and the Blind Sheikh. So those are all words that are coming out of the joint inquiry 28 pages. And, you know, most people don't take the time to actually read it because, you know, there's a lot of redactions. It's very confused. Even still, even after it's been declassified, there's still a lot of redactions in there. But and then with regard to the UAE, then this is going to come from page 138 of the commission report. According to the commission report, the UAE was becoming both a valued counterterrorism ally of the U.S. and a persistent counterterrorism problem. So, you know, they touched on it briefly. They talked about a little outing where, you know, Osama bin Laden, I think, regularly visited a compound where the Emirati princes were. And there was an attempt, or they were going to try to take him out, but because they might also take out one of the princes, they you know, derailed the whole operation, and they didn't, and missed that opportunity. So that's what we sort of know, you know, as far as money. There's other things, you know, other money, monetary, you know, checks and things that we've sort of seen, but we're hoping that all gets uncovered in our lawsuit.
Also, Lori, could you talk about the fact that Saudi Arabia has hired several of the largest public relations firms in America, several people that are household names, to go before Congress, quietly lobby members of Congress to kill this particular piece of legislation so that Saudi Arabia cannot be deposed, cannot be questioned in a court of law, and would not be fined. And they're working very hard. The public is not aware that the media never covers it. I've yet to see a single member of the media say, we have absolute evidence. By the way, this evidence exists, that these firms are working on behalf of Saudi Arabia and against the interests of the 9/11 families and the 2,900 people who died. And you don't hear a word about that. But John McCain and others who should be for all this have now, many of them, switched. And I can only assume that lobbying had something to do with this, knowing how easy it is for politicians to look in a different direction where the money is. Your thoughts?
Well, if you go to the website, 28pages.org, it looks like to me I counted 42 lobbying firms that Saudi Arabia had hired, and I'm not exactly sure if I'm right, you know, about how that all broke down, but it looked like they spent some $11 million lobbying against JASTA. So JASTA is the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act that was, you know, passed, got through Congress and was vetoed by the president, but then actually made it onto, you know, is the law of the land in the United States. And, you know, JASTA, we needed JASTA in order to sue Saudi Arabia because our lawsuit started in 2002 against Saudi Arabia, but it's been, you know, delayed and dismissed and, you know, all these crazy things because they enjoyed, you know, both the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the UAE enjoy sovereign immunity. And sovereign immunity basically says the king can do no wrong. However, we don't think there should be immunity when 3,000 people die and, you know, planes are hijacked and buildings are knocked down. So we went to try to lift that sovereign immunity because these countries are not on the sponsors of terrorism list. There are only three countries that are actually on that list in Saudi Arabia and the UAE, although they sponsor terrorism. They're not on that list. It's just Iran, Sudan, and Syria that are on the list right now. So in any case, we needed JASTA to hold these countries accountable for their role in 9/11. And JASTA removed the sovereign immunity, as I said, that supports terrorist attacks on the U.S. And it's only on U.S. soil that law applies. It amended the ATA, which is the anti-terrorism statute. And also, I think it amended the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And so they could not be sued because they weren't on the list and they had sovereign immunity. So then we had to go get JASTA to list sovereign immunity, and that's where we end up now. Saudi Arabia hired some 42, it looks like. I don't know if that's right, but that's what I'm counting, lobbying firms to lobby against JASTA to weaken the law. And they hired U.S. veterans, some of these guys who signed up for the military to pretty much avenge 9/11, didn't know they were actually, you know, sort of going against the 9/11 families to do this because they were told that, you know, JASTA could hurt them somehow, you know, when they're fighting, or they could be sued, and they were, you know, basically lying to them. And all that information is false. And they went to Washington. They were paid by Saudi Arabia. These veterans were, you know, their hotel bills were paid and their transit, you know, the travel costs were paid. And they didn't know who they were working for, really, for the most part. Some of them knew, but most of them did not. And then they came clean and they reached out to some of the 9/11 families to say this is what's happening. And that's how it all started to get uncovered. And, you know, it's pretty heinous. And no, it has not been reported on adequately at all. Which is really, you know, kind of heartbreaking because it's this crazy story that's true and nobody knows about it.
Okay.
But
Lori,
JASTA remains.
Good. Lori, could you imagine what a conundrum this would create if Saudi Arabia was found guilty of being complicit in 9/11? then we would have an entire national debate. On one side would be the pro-war and the pro-military-industrial complex saying, well, even though they were part of it and even though they funded it, somehow they should be forgiven. And the others would be the rest of Americans who still have a consciousness soul. And they would say, look, the worst terrorist crime on American soil has occurred. These people should be persona non grata. They should never be dealt with by any company or the United States government. And they should be now the number one terrorist state in the country. Let's go over to Les. Give us your intake on the 9/11. What's new and revelatory from your position about the 28 pages from the 9/11 Commission report that was not made public? And also the commission and George Bush specifically in the White House did everything they could to keep this classified. Give us your input on this, please.
Yeah, that was very interesting. In those years, when the joint inquiry on 9/11 was operating, Gary, this was from 2001, 2002. And at that point, the plans were being put into operation to invade Iraq. I hope everybody can remember the at that point in time with the demonizing of Saddam Hussein and the whole scenario with weapons of mass destruction being alleged and nuclear tubes and yellow tape from Niger and so forth. There was an absolute hell-bent intention to invade Iraq, which they did. The U.S. did, of course, in 2003. Now, imagine if the 28 pages, which very much indicts elements of in high levels within the Saudi Arabian government for complicity in 9/11, having to do with the financing, how in the world could the U.S. all of a sudden invade Iraq? It would have been impossible. So that chapter had to be kept secret. And I also believe very strongly, given the research out there on the Bush family relationship with the Saudi monarchy and, of course, Prince Bandar, who was being called Bandar Bush by the Bush family, that they very much wanted to protect all of the indications of Saudi complicity and the role of Prince Bandar that is found within the 28 pages, including actual numbers, financial numbers being passed to Omar al-Bayoumi and Osama Basnan and also to the wife of Bayoumi, that totals $99,000. This is what's in the 28 pages, which if anybody has not read the 28 pages, you can download it at the website hr14.org, and I urge you to do so. So that's what I believe the main reasons were for the classification of that chapter, because definitely there was no threat to national security, which was the reason given.
Les, also give us your insight into the Saudi Arabian and United Arab Emirates attacks against Iran, because as we know from my office, Iran and Kuwait have been engaged in natural gas sharing because Kuwait has the largest natural gas reserves in that part of the world, and where they don't have a lot of oil, they have natural gas. They're a tiny little appendage of a country, but they have the highest income per population in the world of any country. And now they're being attacked by Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. And now we find out that it was United Arab Emirates that hacked into their system, creating false information about the emir, the ruler of Kuwait, that was all false. And yet there is absolute evidence that one country undermined another country, and yet we're still the ally of the country that is now known worldwide as hacking into the computer system of Kuwait. because of the alliance between Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Bahrain, Qatar, not...
Exactly. This is very intriguing in many respects here because the allegation against Qatar is that they made some positive statements about Iran, basically conciliatory or statements that were very reasonable in trying to have a relationship with Iran and also supposedly the Muslim Brotherhood. But the other interesting part about the demands of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, and Kuwait of Qatar is they want Al Jazeera closed down. Now, why is that? I think that's a big part of it, because Al Jazeera is, they put out an awful lot of independent and objective reporting, which is often critical of these the Saudi team there that I just named. And they don't like to be criticized and exposed. And so Qatar, who has been acting independently and, of course, as you say, has the largest natural gas reserves there in the region, poses a threat, and to their domination of the region, and so anything they can do also to attack Iran, even if it's by association here, they will do, because the Saudis are arch enemies with Iran, and this is. Yeah.
Let's just hold your thoughts, because Michael, you're also familiar with the conflict now between all of the Arab League people in that area of the world working together against Qatar. Mm-hmm. Explain from your perspective, having been in that area of the world for a long time, what do you see it as being?
Well, I see it as being the President Donald Trump going to Saudi Arabia and making statements about the Iranians and Shiism and how we have to stop these terrorists, and essentially giving the green light to the untempered, inexperienced Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is the architect of the disaster in Yemen and has been pushing for a confrontation with Iran. And he felt that they could push the Qataris around. There's only 300,000 Qataris in the whole country, along with 2,300,000 expatriates or thereabouts. And they see them as a way of removing an irritant that supports the Muslim Brotherhood, detested by the Saudis and their allies, the Egyptians. The Qataris have good relations with Iran and want to use diplomacy instead of saber-rattling to deal with disputes in the region. And I think, in addition, you've got the problem with... the fact that the Qataris believe they are the rightful rulers of the Najd, which is the central part of Saudi Arabia. The whole issue is one of Saudi Arabia being much more aggressive than it's been in the past. At one point, they believed that the Saudis were always leading from the rear, that if the joke among the expatriates in the kingdom was if Iran attacked Saudi Arabia, the Koreans would likely get the contract to defend the country. But now that they've improved their relations with Israel and have the backing of the United States, the Saudis believe that they can go after the Qataris and demand that they cut off their relations with not only with Iran but with Hamas. Hezbollah, the only effective Lebanese opposition to Israel, as well as the Muslim Brotherhood. They, as for saying that they support terrorism, well, the Saudis support terrorism as well. They just support different groups, perhaps. And there is no real difference, as far as I can see, in any of this. But the sensible thing to do is for the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, an organization set up by the Saudis in 81, is simply wind down these tensions and abandon their ill-conceived efforts to pressure the country into submission. But they look to be trying to ratchet up the pressures on the place, and continue the blockade, not only of economic goods, but and finance the foodstuffs as well, which Iran and Turkey are making up for. And, of course, there's the possibility of another Saudi incursion. They had one before back in 1974. They could well lead to the overthrow of the real government of Qatar and its replacement by a puppetry of Quislings. I would imagine that the most appealing to Mohammed bin Salman is his number three, invade the place again. And, you know, they can overwhelm them. The Saudis spend over $60 billion a year in weapons, and the Qataris, it's maybe $20 billion. And they've got 350 tanks and armored fighting vehicles in all of Qatar, and the Saudis have more than 10,000. And the same thing goes with aircraft. It'll be a walkover, and the Saudis would lose what little reputation they still have in the region and the world, but as long as they can continue pumping oil,
they'll still have a friend in Donald Trump and all of Washington, Democrat and Republican, Clintons. They'd all love the Saudis, irrespective of them being behind 9/11. Or mass murders and genocide throughout the world in terrorists. It's just deplorable, our two-party system. They're both just, you know, fetid, putrid, and without any redeeming value. That's why we need to look at new parties that represent the people and not the oligarchs. Michael Springman and Les Jamieson and Lori Van Auken, thank you all for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.